Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm. Escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza. It's a beautiful sunny May day here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. Off air, I am the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network. But on air, as host of the Farm Report, I talk with folks all along the food chain about food production and how we do think about it, how we maybe should be thinking about it. And today I'm excited to have us joined on the line by Jose Oliva. He's the co-director of the Food Chain Workers Alliance. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Erin. I'm glad to be here.
So we are kind of continuing our ongoing coverage and partnership with Slow Food USA in preparation for their Slow Meat Conference, Summit Conference, that's coming up this June. And Jose, we got connected through Megan, who's my co-producer on this series. And, you know, your organization, the Food Chain Workers Alliance, is really a coalition of worker-based orgs, really thinking broadly about the entire food chain, from the people who plant, harvest, process, pack, transport, prepare, serve, and sell our food. And your organization is looking to support fair wages and enhance working conditions for everyone along this food chain, which is super exciting. I feel like your organization in a lot of ways is an organizational representation of what I try to highlight on my show every week. Can you tell us a little bit about how the group got started and how you got involved?
Sure, absolutely. As you said, we're a membership-based organization. We're made up of groups that represent food workers, from farms to processing plants to restaurants, right? So what I like to say is that from field to fork, it's our members that make food happen. Our combined membership is close to 300,000 strong. We got started a little bit over 5 years ago. And, when we got started, the reason we got started is that many of our members, I was actually a restaurant worker for many, many years and was one of the participants of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which is one of the restaurant worker organizations in the U.S. And we had tons of people coming to us, members, restaurant workers, who were telling us our clients, our customers, come into our restaurant and they ask about the food. They ask about whether this chicken is organic. They ask about, where these berries were grown. They ask about whether there were pesticides used in this particular salad. But no one ever asks about the workers, right? The people who are actually growing the food, who are transporting the food, who are serving the food. And so it became pretty evident to us that there was this need, right, to create some kind of presence in the growing discourse around food that talked specifically about workers. And so ROC, along with a few other organizations, including the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a farm worker group down in Immokalee, Florida, along with Brand Workers, which is another group right there in your backyard in New York, along with Northwest Arkansas Workers Center, which, organizes poultry workers or poultry processing workers. We all came together and decided to form this Food Chain Workers Alliance. And the alliance, originally our goal was let's insert workers into this ongoing conversation around food, right, so that we are also at the table when we're talking about, you know, how to improve our food system. And what we noticed in the process of doing that is that the food movement itself was sort of subdivided into these three other categories, right? There were folks who were concerned about what food does to the human body, so health folks, right? There were folks who were concerned about what food does to our environment. And then there were folks who were concerned about what food does to communities, both in terms of access to good food in low-income communities of color, and also in terms of urban ag and rural agriculture as well, right? So as we grew and as our presence and our footprint grew inside of the food movement, we started to realize that we needed to actually speak with one voice, given that the problems that we're looking at in the food system are actually not about one of the areas, right? It's ultimately the bad food that is being grown, that's making us sick, that's also destroying the environment, and that pays low wages and bad working conditions for workers, right? So systemically, we have to change that. It's not about, you know, the workers only, or the health of the human being only, or the health of the environment only. So that's it. That's our story. Since we started in 2008, we started to do a lot of work bringing together those four elements of the food movement. We're now at the point where we're pushing local municipal ordinances that we're referring to as the good food purchasing policies as a way of actually unifying the food movement, right? Because each one of these purchasing policies, what it does is creates a filter for the food that is bought by municipalities, right? So right now in most municipalities, people or the folks who are in charge of buying the food for that municipality have one criteria, which is buy the cheapest food. And what we're saying is that's not enough, right? We need to buy good food for the kids of our public school systems, and we need to buy healthy food for our environment, and we need to buy food that actually feeds the economic incentives of our own communities, right, and pays living wages and good working conditions. So that's what the good food purchasing policies do. We recently passed one in L.A. in 2012, and now currently are working in New York and in Chicago and a couple of other places in the Bay Area, for instance, to pass good food purchasing policies there.
Well, I want to.
So that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about those purchasing policies and the good food pledge in just a minute. But before we do, I want to kind of orient folks a little bit more to the people and the kind of difference. The different kind of like wages and the number of people we're talking about who are part of this employment sector when we look at the food chain. You guys have this great video, I think it's pretty new, called Guess Who's Coming to Breakfast. And I just like, I thought it was so smart. You know, it's a family sitting around the breakfast table and you think, you know, the kid's going to have, you know, a question about the birds and the bees and where do babies come from? But he's like asking his parents, where does food come from? And they're like, it comes from the store. And immediately there's this parade of all the people who, as we said earlier, are planting and harvesting and processing and packing. So can you give us a little sense of scale? You know, how big is this industry? And then kind of as a follow-up to that, when we're looking at these workers, you know, from the farm to the store or to the restaurant, is there a group that is most affected or most critically in need of kind of support or attention? You know, where are the kind of real target zones, if there are any?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Yeah, so when we talk about the food system from an economic perspective, we're talking about the largest private sector employer in the United States, right, with well over 20 million workers. So, you know, you can do this informal poll right now with some of the folks around you. But if you ask people who has worked in a restaurant, you'll always get people raising their hands, right? It's about 50% of Americans who have worked or will work in the restaurant industry. It's a huge number. So restaurant workers by themselves are about 13 million of that 20 million number.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, again, from an economic perspective, the interesting thing about the food system is that because it is now the largest private sector employer, it is actually setting trends. It's setting wages and conditions trends for the rest of the economy. So think of it this way. When we had manufacturing as the core of our economy, their wages and their conditions set the tone for the rest of the economy, right? So people needed to compete from a supply and demand point of view with manufacturing when they offered jobs. And so that meant that you had relatively high wages, or not high necessarily, but livable wages.
Right.
And you had some benefits that were offered by most employers. As manufacturing became less prevalent in our economy, and now obviously it's almost completely decimated, and as the food system began to take over, those wages and those conditions just took a nosedive, right? The average wage for a food worker is in the $8.50 an hour range. So food workers are actually two times more likely to seek out assistance for food than anyone else in the work in our workplace. So it's an interesting juxtaposition, right? We went from having relatively livable wages in workplaces to basically McJobs, right, in the last 3 decades. And that transition is in part because the food system has grown tremendously, in part because the food system represents a new model, a new economic model that has less centralized workplaces, so the workplaces are a lot smaller, making it less likely for them to have a union. They also represent a new demographic, right? So close to 70% of tipped workers in the United States are women, and over half of those women are earning poverty wages. And so you're talking about not just a new demographic, but sort of a new mode of production.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that new mode of production, a race to the bottom, right? An absolute race to see who can pay the least amount and who can actually squeeze workers the most. And that's creating, essentially this vacuum in our economy for livable wage jobs and for good working conditions.
And if we're looking, I mean, if we're turning the lens kind of back to the farm and we're thinking about kind of farmers, farm owners, farm workers, farm workforce, I mean, are we seeing that across the spectrum, these groups are impacted by this wage crunch, or is it like workers are feeling much more of the brunt than farm owners? Or are we, seeing different changes depending on like the size or even the type of thing that farms are producing? I mean, are there bright spots or dark spots in the kind of farm landscape?
That's another great question. So, in terms of the farming, the framework for farm owners, the main issue is fair pricing. So a lot of, I'm obviously not an expert on farm ownership or farmers in general, but I can tell you that the folks that I know who are have all made it perfectly clear that the main problem is that the way that pricing is structured right now, it incentivizes large corporate-owned factory farms, and it penalizes smaller, medium-sized farmers. And so we end up with essentially the same situation that you have for workers being the reality for farmers, right? Which means that if you're a large farmer, large farm owner, you can afford, and not only can you afford to have very low prices for your products, but you're being subsidized at a very high level by the federal government to continue to bring those prices down, which undercuts, obviously, the smaller, medium-sized farmers. Now, what ends up happening on the labor front for those folks is that, obviously, the smaller to medium-sized farmer can't afford to pay livable wages. Oftentimes, they can't afford to pay themselves livable wages, right? And they have to sell off their farms and move somewhere else. And so it ends up becoming this, you know, vicious cycle of the smaller farmers paying less wages or lower wages, and the larger farms, the big corporate factory farms, not necessarily paying higher wages, but having nothing to compete against, they can pay workers very low wages and get away with it. And so, we end up with a really vicious cycle, race to the bottom, where smaller farmers are being squeezed on both ends, and the incentive is basically to be either sell off your land, sell the land to a large corporate factory farm, or to become something else, to move on into a different industry.
Well, so shifting gears a little bit here, and thinking about the Slow Meat Conference that's happening in Denver, you know, why is it important for your organization to be in attendance there? Like, what are you hoping to get and to walk away with? And where you can, are there issues that are specific to meat and the meat industry that, you know, are different than things you're finding in other types of production?
Yeah. So we're attending and we're involved in the slow meat movement for two reasons. One, it's everything that is better for the environment and for our health is also better for workers. And so we're very, very clear about that, that to the extent that we're able to move our market in the direction of better food, right? That means food that is that has these five very critical elements, right? That's locally grown, that's sustainable, that's fair, that's humane, and that's healthy. That if we move in the direction of a food system that has those five elements, I think we're doing what's right for workers. So that's number one. Number two, we do think that the way we're going to be able to move our food system, the way that we're going to be able to create a good food system, is if we break out of our silos. So if we stop thinking about, our health as the primary, most important thing, but we start to realize that our health is directly connected to the working conditions and the environmental conditions of that factory farm, then we're going to get somewhere. Right? But to the extent that we're only focused on one of those elements, I think that's where we oftentimes hit a wall, both because we can't move a large corporation like Monsanto or Walmart or Garden in the direction of better, healthier food, given that their commitment is number one to profits and everything else is secondary. So to the extent that we're able to unify all of our demands and everything that we need, then we can get somewhere. So that's the second reason that we're going to the conference.
Well, I think that your like narrative really strikes me in that it seems like very efficient, essentially, with like in one fell swoop, I get to eat like better, healthier food that also has these great impacts on the people who are producing it and the land upon which it is produced. We have just a few minutes left, and so I want to touch on one of the tools that your team has been working on that you alluded to a little earlier in the interview, which is the Good Food Purchasing Program. I know that you have launched in LA. I was surprised. I did not know that LA, has 10 million residents, which is about 26% of California's population. Tell us a little bit about the Good Food Purchasing Pledge. And I think in particular to me, it was interesting that you're targeting working with a specific municipality and that you're looking at food service institutions with budgets over $1 million. So why start at this level, and why was that $1 million mark the right space to target?
Right. That's where we're at now, but that doesn't mean that's where it's going to stay. What we wanted to do is we wanted to have an impact on the market. So the bottom line to us is the city of L.A. spends a little bit over $2.75 billion with a B.
With a B, on yeah.
Food, on food every year. So that's 400,000 meals every day that are served in L.A. public schools and in L.A. Other services that L.A. provides. So to us, it was pretty clear that if we could move that market, if we could move that humongous market, we could have a regional impact. So the idea emerged as a conversation that we were having with several of our other partners in the L.A. Food Policy Council that represented different sectors of the food movement, right? So there were folks who were pushing and were concerned on issues of local purchasing and ensuring that both local businesses, local small and medium-sized businesses that grow food were able to access the sort of growing market of the municipality. And then there were other folks who were concerned, obviously, on the systemic, sustainable, and environmental impacts of growing food at the scale, monoculture especially, that some of the farms in the valley were growing. And obviously there were folks, we were at the table, right, so there were folks who were concerned about how workers were treated in these operations and in some of the food service providers in the city. And so the conversation really evolved from what can we do together to how can we move the market in the direction that we need it to go, literally for our own survival, right, as a species. And so the idea of putting it into a municipal code wasn't really far-fetched. It was more of a sort of an organic, no pun intended, product of the conversation. And really the five basic principles that the GFPP, the Good Food Purchasing Policy, contains sort of reflect the folks who were at the table, right? So there were local is the first one, right? And there were a lot of businesses and local folks who wanted to eat local. Sustainable is the second one. So there were tons of environmental organizations that were part of that conversation. Fair is the third one, and that obviously reflects on working conditions and wages. Humane is the fourth one, and it's all around animal well-being and animal agriculture. And the fifth one is healthy, so it's just around nutrition and ensuring that we have the best product, that we're consuming the best product that's available. And then moving that, turning that into a policy, which is, I know, could be boring to some folks. To us, it was exciting because it meant that we can create a filter, like I said at the top end of the show, right? We can create a filter that tells our municipality what the food is that we should be buying, so that it isn't just a matter of this is the cheapest thing available and therefore that's what we're going to buy, to, you know, having these five value categories that allow for the food to actually have more of an impact on our health and our environment and our society than what we would have if it wasn't if we had no values for our food at all.
Yeah, well, definitely exciting stuff. And if folks want to learn more, I recommend they check out goodfoodla.org. Jose, it's been really great chatting with you today. I appreciate you taking some time, and I look forward to seeing you out in Denver in June.
Oh, absolutely, Erin. Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to hear more from the food chain workers, you can find them at foodchainworkers.org or on Twitter. They are at foodchainworker. We are going to take a quick station break, and when we come back, we will be joined in studio by a very special guest. I'm excited to introduce you to one of the new supporters of the network and this show. So definitely hang tight through the break. We'll be right back.
Farm Escape. EscapeMaker.com, a guide to local getaways, is offering a two-night farm escape that includes lodging, a visit to an apiary, wine tasting at a vineyard, and a special tour of Bobolink Dairy and Bakehouse in Milford, New Jersey. Transportation is included. For details, visit EscapeMaker.com or come by the Bobolink Dairy stand at the new open-air Fulton Stall Market on Front Street in the South Street Seaport District. Located where New York City's public food markets began in the 1800s, Fulton Stall Market is open weekends 10 to 5 and is the first farmers market in the city to offer ready-to-eat foods made by the farmers who produce them, along with a radio station, live music, and cooking workshops for families. Now offering spring flowers and plants, organic vegetables, pizza made in a wood-burning oven using farm ingredients, local fruit preserves, yogurts, and ice cream, and Bobolink Dairy's famous artisanal cheese and breads. The market is a great reason to rediscover the authentic seaport. For more information, visit FultonStallMarket.com.
We are students at Girls Prep, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report, and we are going to bring you more of that lovely voice you heard on the break. We are joined in the studio by Chris De La Torre. How'd I do?
Pretty good.
Awesome. I wanted to add more like to it, but I got nervous. Of EscapeMaker.com. EscapeMaker.com is a new underwriter of the Heritage Radio Network. And every week on the Farm Report throughout the summer, we're going to be hearing a little bit from them. They're going to be highlighting some amazing opportunities to explore the food and farming world beyond the studio doors. But we thought we would kick it off with a little bit of an introduction for our listeners. On EscapeMaker.com, we'll get a chance to hear from Chris about their work and what you guys can look forward to on the weekly update from them. So jumping in, I mean, we heard a little bit obviously in the break, but EscapeMaker, what can folks expect if they hit up the website and start to explore your services a little bit?
Cool. Well, first, thank you so much for having me in the studio. It's always really fun to come over to Roberta's. We have so many projects going right now to promote farm visits and agritourism and bringing on some farm partners to Heritage, to your show, is a big part of letting people know what options there are in and outside of the city so that they can get involved in understanding where their food comes from, but also as a really important component of economic development for regional farms. So we are kind of tackling this from a couple of different ways. One is you can visit us at Grow NYC Green Markets all season long. We're popping up all around the city to talk to consumers about farm visits that they can go on and any special events that are coming up in the season. We're handing out apples, courtesy of New York Apple
free
Association.
Free apples.
They've been a hit. People love free things in the market, and the apples are beautiful. And you can take an apple from us and then go speak to the grower who's typically in the market, you know, a couple stands down. So there's like a nice synchronicity there, we'll say. So that's one thing. And then we've got farmers coming in to tell you in their words what they're up to out on the farm. And then very, very soon, you're going to be able to go to our website and find packages that it's kind of a neat little bundle of how you get to the farm, what you can do on the farm, and either a farm overnight stay or a place nearby, like a local B&B. And so we're developing relationships and kind of connecting the dots between regional transportation options. And we're really trying to prioritize alternative means of transportation. So maybe if you don't have a car, but you still want to get out of the city, we're going to give you as much opportunity and information to do that.
That is like definitely where I'm at. I'm like, no car. What do I do?
So many people. And there is something that, you know, that adds an experiential component, even if you do have a car and maybe you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint, or maybe you just haven't been on Metro North, let's say, and seen the beautiful ride from Grand Central Station out to Poughkeepsie. And along the way, there are a lot of sort of agriculturally relevant stops that you can visit. It's really a nice experience.
That's awesome. So I think, you know, one of the things that I feel like I really gained looking at agritourism is there's something so informative. There's like such a learning experience about actually putting your feet to the ground and being on a farm, talking with food producers in essentially like their hood. And you know, the benefits of that are kind of beyond what you get as like your personal experience, but it also becomes this whole other kind of economic engine and resource for producers in the region to draw a little more income from some different sources. How do you guys decide what producers are a good fit to work with?
That is a great question and an excellent point about sort of the economic strength of offering some sort of farm visit or class. Right now, we are connecting with farmers, primarily farmers who are associated with Grow NYC and the New York City Green Market, not exclusively, but those are some of our first partners. And these are people who are very enthusiastic to share their mission, share how they're growing, how they're taking care of their animals, how they're taking care of their land, which I think it means a lot to them. They're so often kind of mired in the farm work, which is a very beautiful and enjoyable thing, but it's hard and time consuming. And to draw people out to them, and they're already passionate about it. They expressed it to us either by filling out an agritourism survey we sent out twice previously. And then also some farmers who have already approached agritourism with like a business model and a very clear objective to like host people. They've hired people specifically to take care of the hospitality side. So those are really great early partners for us.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think too, having spent some time on a farm, it's great to essentially kind of control that visitor experience. You want to be like warm and welcoming anytime someone shows up, but ultimately like you're on a schedule. and being able to create a little bit more of a structure where you can kind of like plan for that visit and really make sure that you're providing someone with like an enhanced experience is like such a tool kit. And it'll be interesting to see as the program develops, like what learnings you guys are going to have about what really works and what maybe you thought might work but wasn't going to.
Oh, yes. That learning curve is already fully happening. Something else that is been a really cool kind of secondary component. I wouldn't say secondary, but an added benefit to working with these farmers in the region is that farmers are involved in their communities. And so we're building travel packages that aren't just to the farm, but they're going to let you know what other interesting options are around the farm. So, for example, let's say you take the train upstate and the farmer maybe comes and picks you up from the station, if that's something we've agreed on, and you go on a farm tour, you take a cheese class, and then you head over to a local B&B that is also purchasing product from the farmer. So that's what you get for your breakfast. And then maybe the next day you go on a hike, or maybe there's a great cultural institution nearby, a great movie theater, or what are some examples?
I'm like ice cream.
Local ice cream. Ice cream for sure. But just so many awesome things just outside of the city, but still very rural, which is really nice.
Yeah. So folks can definitely find you guys by visiting the website, which is super simple, escapemaker.com. One of the functions I love is, you know, you can search by date, you can search by distance, or you can search by destination. So you don't really have to necessarily like know what you're looking for. You can kind of have the experience to kind of stumble upon or get inspired by some of the stuff that you guys have outlined. Or I can find tools that really help me stick to a particular criteria or a particular region if that's what I'm interested in. So each week, basically, you're going to be pairing us up with different producers that you work with, and we're going to get a chance to chat with farmers and producers about what you can expect if you visit the farm. So super excited. Definitely stay tuned for that. That's going to be at the end of every farm report throughout the summer. Chris, anything that's coming up in the next couple that folks should kind of put on their calendar now?
Yes. So this Saturday, we will have our pop-up stand at the Fort Greene Market. May 30th, we will be in Tribeca on their Saturday market. And June 17th, we'll be at Getaway Day in Grand Central. We'll be joined by a lot of other destination partners. And any excuse to go to Grand Central Station recreationally, you should, because it's one of our really special New York City buildings. Another thing, follow us on social media. Coming up this weekend and next, you'll get some sneak peeks into a video series we're going upstate to shoot with some of our partners, Breezy Hill Orchard and Wilklo, as well as Bad Seed Cider. So it's going to be really, really fun.
I'm a little bit jealous, as like this is like perfect cider drinking weather. Awesome. Well, like I said, look forward to more from Escape Maker on the Farm Report every week throughout the summer. In the meantime, visit them at one of the farmers markets if you're here in the city, and via the World Wide Web at escapemaker.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been another episode of the Farm Report. We come to you live every Thursday at 1 o'clock. If you like the program, please find us on iTunes and subscribe. Better yet, leave a review. It really helps other folks find the show and like it, like I hope you do. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.